I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. I'm actually going to skip these slides because I figure the epi of the problem of concussions in youth sports is out there, but I could not put slides available on a website without this information there. I think it's the lawyer in me needing to back up what I say. Suffice it to say, it's an established problem. This slide, I just wanted to show you the pace with which these concussion laws were enacted. Before 2009, Texas had a law that addressed youth sports concussion education of coaches, but it was not a comprehensive Lightstedt law. In 2009, when Washington State passed its Lightstedt law, other states took off wildfire. By this year, all states except for Mississippi, and that includes D.C., which is why it's 50, have enacted some sort of youth sports concussion law. I'm not sure how often that happens in public health. I think it's pretty rare. So as far as the common provisions in these laws, there are three key components of the Lightstedt Law. It's kind of held up as a gold standard. Education for athletes and for their parents, immediate removal from play of a concussed athlete, and some kind of return to play restrictions with medical evaluation. Again, those are the key components. There are some other things that may be important that aren't held up as part of the three prongs that are part of this gold standard, and that might be things like training for coaches and officials on a periodic, regular basis, and also return to learn provisions. So I did some work early on, you know, through my capacity at the Network for Public Health Law, looking at these laws that had passed, what was common about them, what provisions they all included, and I did a 50-state survey, and I looked at them, and I'm like, okay, these are all very similar. There's very little experimental policy experimentation going on across the states. And so, obviously, the next step is going to be, do they work? Are they having any impact in the outcomes that we would hope to see an impact on? You know, we talked a little bit earlier about lag time between policy enactment and when you would expect to see an outcome. And at this point, it really is too early to kind of look at incidents of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's hard to say before you've eaten lunch. Early onset dementia, suicide risk, things like that that are really going to require more time to gather the data and to see an effect. But I feel like now is the time to lay the groundwork for those future studies by looking at how these laws are being implemented. And I talked about how the provisions of each of these laws are so similar, but we had this feeling that the similarity in the language or the text of the law may actually obscure some real differences that are happening in implementation. So the law on the books could be very different from what's actually happening in play. So what we did was we decided to just talk to people in the states where these laws have been passed, to the people who are charged with implementation in the law, just to get a sense from them of what was working, what's not working, what's helping you with implementation, what's holding you back, and that way to kind of gather information about that we could share with other people, not just related to these concussion laws and implementing them, but with any kind of public health law initiative moving forward. So we did exploratory phone interviews with state officials and leaders of organizations like athletic associations that were named in the law as charged with implementation. We did get IRB waivers from both of our institutions. We sent recruitment emails to contacts in 42 states and the District of Columbia, and we got a really good response rate. I feel like 81% is pretty respectable. We were able to get 36 respondents in 35 states, and that's because two people in Connecticut wanted to talk to us. Go Connecticut. Okay, so this is just to show you, we had a pretty good geographic distribution of respondents. The blue states are those that participated. Okay, moving on to results. This jives exactly with what Scott was talking about earlier, that people really are not deluded into thinking that it's enforcement of these laws that's going to make an impact. They really believe that it's the heightened awareness of the problem and the culture change in sports that's really going to have an impact here. That was an almost universal belief when we asked them the question, what about these laws do you think is going to work? And they said increased awareness. Some people also said having a standardized return to play protocol is going to help as well. Several states are actually voluntarily increasing the coverage of the law. So if the law requires provisions to apply to high school sports, some states actually expanded that to recreational sports and to middle schools. There are also some primary prevention initiatives that have emerged out of these laws. For example, requiring rules that limit, you know, head-to-head hits or tackling of, receivers who are vulnerable. As far as promoting factors, things that have been helping people implement these laws, a clear delegation of authority in the text of the law, a clear delegation of who's responsible for what, was seen to be helpful and kind of eased implementation. Pre-existing resources and partnerships came up a lot as something that was really helpful. For example, grants, data collection programs that already existed at universities, partnerships with local NFL teams or with their brain injury associations, and also prior state level activity in this issue. Many people said, you know, these laws basically just codified what we were already doing, what we were already planning to do in the coming year. So as far as things that have inhibited implementation of these laws, several of our respondents cited vagueness of statutory language or imprecise statutory language. And just some examples of that are the definition of youth. So it says youth sports concussions, but it's not specific as to whether that includes middle schoolers, whether that includes elementary school, whether that includes recreational leagues or the like. And also this really dicey question of which medical providers can authorize return to play. It understandably makes some providers nervous to have this designation in the laws. Also a limited time to comply. A lot of these laws were emergency legislation where they had an immediate effective date, and so some people reported that they were scrambling to get into compliance. Some of the laws were effective in July, and as some of you may know, football starts up their practices in July oftentimes, and so this quote kind of illustrates their experience. Football had already started, we had to scramble to get all of our schools in compliance. Another problem, and this actually, I talked earlier about some states were able to expand coverage of the law to include rec sports in middle school, for example. Some states were not able to do that because of the decentralized nature of rec sports. High school is a little bit easier because there are high school athletic associations that kind of create this centralized governance place from where the regulations can happen, and that's not true for recreational sports. Some complained about an unfunded mandate. This is something that you hear all the time. There's a lack of an attached fiscal note, which in this climate is less than ideal. Another thing that we heard a lot was where the implementers were not involved in the lawmaking process. Associations and agencies that were involved reported far fewer barriers with implementation. An example of that is in Alaska, they had original wording in the law that required a qualification for a provider to make a return to play decision, but there is no such qualification procedure in Alaska, so several providers were afraid to make a return to play decision, to sign off on the form, because the law requires a qualification in Alaska, so they worked to get that out of the language. If the implementers were involved in the lawmaking process, that language would not have been there, arguably, from the get-go. Another problem that we heard reported was that the law applies to middle school students, but the high school athletic association is charged with implementation, and they're like, we don't have any purview over middle schools, how are we supposed to do this? And here's another compliance challenge. I love this picture. I'm so happy that I found it. This is a polar bear at Barrow High School in Barrow, Alaska. So imagine showing up for football practice and seeing that. So obviously a problem in rural areas is access to authorized personnel, people who are authorized to make return to play decisions. This is that same football field. You can kind of see it on the right there, that blue rectangle. This is an aerial view. So just take a look at that picture and think of how many qualified medical providers there are. And when you add that to the whole debate about who should be allowed to make return to play decisions, it should be a neurosurgeon, it should be a neuropsychologist, it should be, how many of those do you think you're going to find in this picture? Probably not many. And I love this quote, because most of our schools in Alaska are small, remote communities with fewer than 50 students in the high school and few medical providers are available, restricting the numbers who were willing to sign off made it even more difficult. Okay, so more compliance challenges. We had a couple of respondents say that they were finding that parents were a barrier, that you know, they wanted their kids to go back into the game before the coaches did, that there was some doctor shopping. One of the people that we talked to said that this problem seemed to be waning over the last year, which would have been last year, so that's encouraging. And I don't know if you all are aware, but the Connecticut Federal Court ruled that cheerleading is not a sport under Title IX. It was completely not related to concussion laws, but it does have an impact in that if this only pertains to athletics, then arguably cheerleading organizations are not going to think that they're covered. And these girls are at a high risk for concussion. Okay, so again, about enforcement. Massachusetts has probably one of the most comprehensive regulations, because they have a set of regulations along with their statute. And despite that, you know, this news report, I think there was something like 5 concussions that happened during this Pee Wee football game, just during one game. There are little to no enforcement mechanisms in any of these laws. There are some provisions like a loss of eligibility for coaching, loss of a coaching permit if they don't go through the coaching education requirement. That's true in Connecticut, for example. But really, there's a belief that the threat of liability will ensure compliance. You know, and again, we talked about culture change also leading to compliance. In terms of evaluation, we asked how many states were collecting data, and I say it this way, at least 7 states are collecting data, because these are the 7 respondents that knew that their states were collecting data. We're cognizant of the fact that there may well be other states collecting data that people we spoke to just weren't aware of. And they were tracking things like incidents. We would expect an increase in incidents, right? And my time is up. I'm going to talk really fast. Compliance and also awareness measures, how many hits there were on the website that talked about concussion. And also, again, states with partnerships were more likely to collect data, obviously, because they had the procedures in place. We asked respondents what did they wish that their state law contained that it didn't. And these were some of the things that they said. They wished that they had some return to learn guidance, training of parents, officials, and students, broader coverage, inclusion of middle schools and recreational sports, some funding, and a better definition of return to play. Okay, so here are my conclusions. So evaluation of concussion laws really should take into account the real differences that are occurring in implementation. So when we codify these laws, there are ways to tease out, you know, through coding and through the methods that Alex talked about, to tease out the nuances in these laws and to make sure that those are captured when comparing to outcomes and behavior change. But we also have to make sure that we're capturing the stuff that's not in the text of the law, but that's actually happening on the ground. We also, you know, need to do this to identify which provisions are actually having a real impact. The other thing that I just want to say is that we really need to make sure that the laws remain current and in line with the current state of the science, that they don't just stay there on the book stagnant and don't develop along with science. An example of this is education methodology. I'm going to talk really fast. So when I signed my son up for baseball, this new pop-up, because Maryland requires education of parents before signing your kid up to play, a pop-up came up, it was like 5-point font, and it said, you know, concussions are really bad. If you have a concussion and you go back into the game, you could be severely injured. I could barely read it, and I have pretty good eyesight, and I just had to click okay, and I could sign my kid up. That qualified as education under the law, and I wonder if that's really what the spirit of the law intended. I wonder if that's good enough to constitute the kind of awareness and education that's going to bring about behavior change. So would be good to look at those kinds of things as well. This study was limited. Obviously, it's limited to the people who chose to respond to us. Others might have had other things that were important to share. Also, 7 of the 35 states that we talked to had been in the implementation phase for less than 12 months, so they had less experience to share with us, but they did mirror the responses of all the other people. Thank you.
Well, as promised, we have about 20 minutes for questions. Since we have one mic, I'm going to suggest that we all sort of lurk around the podium here and step in as the questions go, and I'll... yes, sir. I just want to thank my brother for that comment. Yes, sir.
So I was intrigued by your theory that laws really work more by making awareness. I wonder what you would advocate in situations where the society is not perhaps ready for the law to change the attitude. So, for example, gun control, where laws can't seem to get passed. So how do you attack a problem like that to try and change the attitude so that the law then can become acceptable?
Well,
and that's the problem a lot of times.
on this panel and in the book across all the chapters, the degree to which we would espouse that view that they work more through awareness than through other stuff, I think there's a diversity of opinion, and there's clearly a huge diversity on exactly what specific behavior or outcome you're talking about. I mean, we have a lot of those internal to the field debates, and I think it's really important. What we're trying to do is to make explicit this debate rather than saying there's one mechanism that always works and one mechanism that doesn't. And so, I almost would disagree a little bit with the premise. I don't remember who said it initially. It might have applied to that particular case. And it's like the debate between the Tom Tyler legitimacy stuff. I think that's really important, but if you read his stuff, he just sort of brushes and says deterrence doesn't work. Well, I've spent decades working in the road safety field, and we have hundreds of studies, and deterrence works. When you increase the enforcement of the speed laws, speeds go down and the fatality rate goes down. We have this in drunk driving. So it's much more nuanced than that. You almost need a particular case. But the larger point is for us, as the community of scientists and public health workers engaged and worried about this, we need to think this through and think through theoretically how these laws work for a whole variety of reasons. One is, if we find out, deterrence works, but it only works in these kinds of situations, and we identify what these kind mean, then that's like a general finding. And when a new public health problem comes up, we can look at that and say, well, that new problem is like the these kind that we find that these legal mechanisms tend to work well. And another one comes up, it's in that kind of area, which seems like from our past research, this other mechanism works well for those kinds of things. I mean, that's how our field is going to advance. That's kind of a more a meta.
Well, Alex and I are like always a little bit lumpers and splitters, and I'm a little bit more of a lumper here. I mean, law is just like everything else, every other kind of behavioral influence. It works probabilistically. It doesn't work uniformly always the same way. And so, for example, Carrie alluded to how fast the adoption curve or how steep the adoption curve was for these Leistat laws, actually it's quite common that that happens. That's one of the things that reminds you of how popular public health law is. You can find example after example where within 5 or 10 years every state has adopted. It's just this, in our current time, besides the concussion laws, there's been rapid adoption of laws about texting and driving, or you know, those have all shot to, we're having the same thing happen now with laws related to drug overdose prevention. I mean, you see it all the time over the years. But, you know, and in fact, I would say that you can find a pretty consistent pattern, which is that where a law deals with a readily imagined or highly available problem, and it does it in a way that is quite clear to the average, you know, to the meanest intelligence that, you know, is likely to have a, interrupt that process, you have a very good likelihood of getting it passed. But not always. Like motorcycle helmet laws, we know they work. But they deviate from that for very specific reasons. Gun control is the same. I think the same thing. There's a little bit of haziness about, you know, it's an example of one of those places like obesity is where there's actually some sort of epidemiological haziness. Is it the gun, or is it the person who has the gun? That's not just the NRA talking. I mean, this problem of violence and why we have higher incidents, it's not quite so easy. And then if you bring in pre-existing intuitions and beliefs, it just makes it one of those things where we're actually having a battle explicitly over the norm rather than sort of a norm that's hanging there and is sort of readily dissipated when you start offering a counter norm. So there's just no pattern. But, you know, I'm not saying that norms always change through law. In fact, the classic legal sociological question was always which comes first, the norm change or the law. And the fact is it's like the chicken and egg problem. They both come first and they both come second. Carrie, maybe you should talk a little bit about, or you don't do advocacy, but I don't want to force you. Do you want to have me
say? I have something I want to say. What did you want me to?
No, go ahead. You say what you're going
to say. So what I was going to say in response to the earlier question, and I think it works for your question too, is I don't think we can discount the role of the media in all of this either. I think they're a powerful partner. With the concussion laws, I mean, there was a host of really well, highly publicized catastrophic injuries and deaths of really young people, and that resonates with the public, right? Same thing with the texting laws, I think. It's all over the news that, you know, high school students killed because they're texting and driving. That resonates with the public. I think part of the problem is some of our public health issues, even when we have the data is there, it lacks that, you know, nonpartisan, heart-tugging narrative that kind of pulls the laws along, and maybe that's the problem here. I mean,
I think it's also a question of time resolution. Again, what is your expected baseline for normal adoption of a massive new way of living? To me, active living, healthy eating, they're doing pretty well. It's 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, I cut my teeth working on needle exchange. You know, we still have a federal ban on a highly effective, we just have a new study that we funded coming out showing how effective it is. That's 20 years on, and lots of states still haven't done it. So, you know, it's frustrating, but I think that we in research, in part, have to change the conversation. And when people say to us, you know, you're not translating what you're doing fast enough, you're not having enough success, it's like, well, compared to what? You know, it is going to be a tough slog, and we do have to have programs like the network to help with the TA. We have to have programs like ours to help get the word out about what works. We have to have research both, you know, making that message stronger. We need the translators, the entrepreneurs, the advocates, the people who are doing this, and we have to just keep slogging. But I don't think we should be thinking of ourselves as failures. I think, you know, the world would be a lot less safe place if people, like the people in the injury section, had not been doing what they've been doing in the last 30 years, and it is having its effect. Esther.
I think one thing that I don't hear enough about in the discussion of mediators and moderators around public health law is not so much enforcement, but implementing regulations. And I think that that's a direction that is difficult, because if you've only got there 20 states, how do you get enough variation in that enough cases in that variable? But I think it's really key that we figure out ways to think more closely about what happened with implementing regs.
Yeah, I wouldn't distinguish. Yeah, I wouldn't distinguish regs from any other kind of legal document. It's just they're harder to, sometimes harder to get. And you know, I think we have to, you know, we have a session this afternoon on in the law section on sort of the politics of health. And clearly, I mean, the world of regs is the world where industry activism against being regulated really comes into play. And certainly, at the federal level, we've just had an almost complete constriction of the veins, you know, of regulation. It's so hard to get a regulation through. State level, you know, I come from a state, Pennsylvania, where it takes, you know, typically 3 years to go through an elaborate process to get a new reg, and we have very little action. You know, some people live in New York. It's a little quicker. They can have the whole thing overturned in, you know, 9 months. So.
No, but in terms of the science, we always start where we are. I mean, I think Ted's making a really important point. But if there's one place where the reg was done well, or we think it's done well, and we don't need, you know, that whole matrix design and everything, that's kind of the goal when it's possible. But if there's a case of one, we have an innovator state, well, then we have to do that individual study of that one case. How did that state do it to make it work so well? How did they structure their regs? How did they structure their implementation mechanisms? And that's a very useful contribution to the literature, and it fosters that diffusion. And then the second state tries it, and the third state tries it. And then a little while later, we can have the study that compares a dozen or more states.
All right, well, if there are no more questions, I want to thank our audience and our panel, and hope to see you all next year.